Okay, when Oliver Cromwell passed from this world on September the 3rd, 1658, which was actually the anniversary of two of his most important military victories, the battles of Dunbar in 1650 and Worcester, both of which he fought against, interestingly enough, Scottish Presbyterians, so that the name of Oliver Cromwell is just as disliked in Scotland as it is in Ireland because of various events in Ireland. There died with him the hopes of a republican England. Nearly a decade earlier, Cromwell, along with other Puritan leaders, had put Charles I, their monarch, on trial for treason and for fomenting the British Civil Wars. The British Civil Wars begin in 1638 with two wars between England and Scotland, and then what's known as the English Civil War, which soon encompassed all of the British Isles, which ran from 1642 to 1651. And the Puritan leaders felt that Charles was a major cause of those. And because he had been in correspondence with his cousin, the King of France, to bring over French troops to fight against his own subjects, the Puritans felt that they had every justification to put him on trial for treason. They found him guilty and executed him on January the 30th, 1649. In place of the monarchy, they had established a republic in which, in the course of the 1650s, Oliver Cromwell came to play the central role. But within 18 months of Cromwell's death, anarchic political conditions gripped the republic, and one of Cromwell's generals, George Monk, decided the monarchy needed to be restored. At the head of his Coldstream Guards, the Coldstream Guards are the longest standing regiments in the British Army. They were founded in 1650 by Monk in the last months of the Civil War. Monk entered London in February of 1660 and announced the restoration of the monarchy in the person of Charles II, the son of the previous monarch who was living in exile at the time in France. He actually moved from exile for a brief period of time to Holland because it was felt that Charles's coming from a Catholic country wouldn't look too good to assume the throne of a Protestant country. So he moved locale for a few weeks to Holland, where he announced his declaration of becoming king, and Holland obviously being a Protestant nation. It's noteworthy that the Cromwellian Republic of the 1650s had known a significant measure of religious freedom. And I think Martin Lloyd-Jones rightly called Oliver Cromwell the father of religious tolerance in England. And Puritan leaders like Monk were hopeful that such could continue. When asked, when Charles was asked, would he guarantee religious liberty, he agreed to in what has become known as the Declaration of Breda, which is a town in Holland where he was living, which guaranteed, quote, liberty to tender consciences, end of quote, and that none, quote, shall be disquieted or called in question for differences of opinion in matter of religion, which do not disturb the peace of the kingdom, end of quote. Whatever Charles's intentions, and that's been a subject of great historical discussion, he actually was a crypto-Roman Catholic, which only came out on his deathbed, and so he might have wanted toleration because it would have brought toleration for fellow Catholics, or it could have been a complete fabrication and lie, and he really wanted the crown more than anything else. Whatever his inner motives, the men who came to power with him were determined to smash Puritanism. The Anglican hierarchy who came to power with Charles II, however, were not at all favorably disposed towards the Puritans, and they tended to view the various religious groupings outside of the established church as disturbers of the peace. Their view seemed to find confirmation in January of 1661 when Thomas Venner, a lay preacher attached to a congregation in Swan Alley, London, and a cooper by profession, led an armed revolt to overthrow Charles II. For 3 days, parts of London were terrorized by the violence of Venner and his followers, who were known as Fifth Monarchists, and were convinced that Christ's kingdom was to be ushered in by such bloody means. Over 40 people were killed in street fighting, with Venner himself killing at least three or four people during the course of the three-day revolt. Unrepentant to the end, he was hanged, drawn, and quartered on January the 19th, which up until about 2 years ago, I'd often used that phrase in lectures, really didn't think about what it meant. It's absolutely horrific in terms of a punishment. Venner affirmed his allegiance to King Jesus and that what he had done had been for the propagation of his, that is Christ's government and rule, and for the advancement of his kingdom. I read, you can actually read this in footnote 3 there, the last speech and prayer with other passages of Thomas Venner, which records his speeches and questions and answers that were actually done on the scaffold before he was hung. And he was completely unrepentant to the end, that this was indeed the way that God's kingdom was to be ushered in. Now, what's significant for our talk here is that Venner had links through his Swan Alley congregation with a number of Baptist leaders. And it's not surprising that one immediate consequence of the uprising was the imprisonment of a large number of Baptists who, despite their attempts to distance themselves from Venner, within a few days of the revolt, a number of Baptist leaders had gotten together, issued a declaration that they had nothing to do with this. This was not their way of thinking about how to bring in the kingdom of the Lord Jesus. But they were now regarded as dangerous to the peace of Charles's kingdom, along with others like the Quakers. The problem with the Quakers is they would not take the oath of allegiance to the king, and Congregationalists, who were regarded as bad as the Baptists. A more far-reaching consequence of the Venner uprising was its strengthening the hand of a body of legislators in what is known as the Cavalier Parliament. This is the parliament that came to power with Charles II, who were bent on the destruction of religious dissent. To this end, between 1661 and 1673, they passed a series of acts known as the Clarendon Code, named after the Earl of Clarendon, who was the key figure, at least for the first 6 years of this, and secured the passage of a number of these acts. And for the sake of reference to what I'm talking about later, I thought it would be helpful to go through a number of these, the major ones, and just give you some ideas to sort of body of legislation that was brought in to destroy the Puritan movement once and for all. First of all, there was the Corporation Act, that should be Act, 1661, which required all magistrates to swear allegiance to the supremacy of the English monarch and to have taken the Lord's Supper in the Anglican Church in the year prior to taking office. One of the ways that this was enforced later was try to undermine religious sense outside the Church of England was towns to sometimes elect Baptists or Presbyterians or Congregationalists to a magistrate's office. They wouldn't be standing for election. The officials would simply tell a Baptist leader, "We've decided to elect you," and then knowing that he would refuse to go along with the requirements of the act, so that they could then legally arrest him. And so it gives you some idea of the horrific hatred that was involved in this particular act. Then the most famous one, this is the one that gives rise to remembering this period of time this year, is the Act of Uniformity, 1662, which came into effect on St. Bartholomew's Day, August the 24th, which was a faithful day indeed, because that was the 90th anniversary of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, when Roman Catholic authorities in France decided to take advantage of a wedding in Paris when a number of French Calvinist leaders came to the wedding to kill them, and issued in a number of frenzied weeks of bloodshed, in which probably somewhere between 15 to maybe as many as 30 or even more thousand French Calvinists were killed, which decimated a number of French Calvinist communities. Almost definitely, the date chosen was done so purposely. The government could not have known, could not have forgotten that particular event. It specified that all worship in England and Wales was to be done according to the Book of Common Prayer, and required every minister of the gospel to declare, quote, his unfeigned assent and consent to all and everything contained and prescribed, end of quote, in this book. This implementation led to the expulsion of somewhere close to 2,000 ministers, very few of whom, no more than maybe 40 or 50, became Baptist ministers. About 1,700 of them became Presbyterians. Then there was the first Conventicle Act, 1664, that forbade the gathering of five or more persons over the age of 16, apart from members of the same household, for worship outside the bounds of the Book of Common Prayer. It was specifically aimed at ministers seeking to form new congregations. It was not primarily aimed at the rank and file, so to speak, of the congregations, but this was specifically aimed at arresting ministers. Being caught for the first time at an illegal conventicle would entail a prison sentence of 3 months. A second offense would mean 6 months in prison, and a third offense, either exile for 7 years, unless a fine of £100 were paid. To get some idea of how much money that is, over 100 years later, William Carey's first pastoral charge at Moulton Baptist Church paid him £30 a year. So it gives you some idea. This is 100 years earlier. It's a massive amount of money. The Five Mile Act, 1665, made it illegal for ministers outside the Church of England to live within 5 miles of the town where they administered prior to 1662, unless they took an oath promising they would not endeavor to make any change in the worship practice of the state church or in the government of the state. And this, again, is designed to prevent ministers gathering congregations. Any violation of this act would result in a fine of £40. So you're looking at probably more than a year's salary, maybe close to 2 years' salary. The Second Conventicle Act, because the First Conventicle Act had been only in force for a set number of years. The Second Conventicle Act levied a fine of 5 shillings. This now attacked the rank and file. It levied a fine of 5 shillings of every person over the age of 16 present at an illegal conventicle, and a £20 fine for allowing such a conventicle to meet on one's property. Unlike the First Conventicle Act, this piece of legislation was clearly aimed at the rank and file of dissent. The Anglican poet Andrew Marvel, he was one of the members of Parliament that passed it. He was involved, rather, in the Parliament that passed it. He dissented from voting in its favor, called it, quote, the quintessence of arbitrary malice. And then the First Test Act, 1673, required all of those holding civil offices, as well as commissioned officers in the Army or Navy, to take an oath of allegiance to the English Crown and receive the Lord's Supper according to the rites of the Anglican Church. This is a way of preventing dissent occupying positions of power in either the Army or the Navy. The Test Act would remain in effect until the 1820s. Further acts after this period of time specified that only Anglicans could be buried in Anglican cemeteries. This was a real problem for Baptists and Congregationalists, Presbyterians and Quakers outside of London, where usually you had one parish church in a town with a cemetery, and if the vicar didn't like dissenters, and you had a relative that died, you were in trouble. You'd have to bury the person in your backyard often. And then only those marriages performed by an Anglican minister were valid. This was in effect up until, again, into the 19th century. Particular Baptist then under the cross. Between 1661, the year that the Clarendon Code began to be passed, and 1688, the year of the so-called Glorious Revolution, when Charles's younger brother, James II, he was an overt Roman Catholic, and when he was finally removed from power by an Anglican coup d'etat and religious toleration finally secured, hundreds of Baptists, along with equal numbers of Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and Quakers, were incarcerated. Pastors were especially targeted, and many of them, if they did emerge from prison, did so with deeply impaired health. There is a long list of pastors and elders who died in prisons. None of them ever actually executed, but for some of these men, the prison was a death sentence because of its wretched conditions. On occasion, full-fledged attacks were carried out on the rank and file of congregations. On June the 29th, 1662, for example, a squad of soldiers came to the Baptist congregation in Petit France. This is an area of London where French Calvinists, Huguenots, had originally settled, and so it became known as Small France. They came, quote, full of rage and violence with their swords drawn. They wounded some and struck others, broke down the gallery, and made much spoil. And the spelling and capitalization is as it was in the original. The following month, when another London Baptist meeting was subjected to a similar attack, one of the attackers, he was a marshal, so he had some government position, whose name was Brown, punched a number of pregnant women in the congregation, quote, striking them with his fist, such blows that made them reel. end of quote. Both of those statements come out of this item. Again, there was a photocopy of that passed out. Behold a cry, or a true relation of the inhumane and violent outrages of divers soldiers, constables, and others practiced upon many of the Lord's people, commonly, though falsely called Anabaptists, at their several meetings in and about London, which was printed in 1662 in a very small anonymous pamphlet, but just simply lists about 25 to 30 such outrages. There were periods of respite. For example, in 1672, when Charles issued a declaration of indulgence, and there were various reasons for this. Charles is going back and forth with Parliament. Charles's realization that maybe his Catholicism needed to be more to the front. And then finally, another period of respite, his brother's declaration of indulgence in 1687. But there was no lasting peace from persecution until 1688. The worst and darkest bout of persecution was just before the dawn of toleration in the early 1680s, when a number of dissenters supported an attempt by the Whig Party in Parliament to prevent Charles's brother, the future James II, from ever becoming king. They wanted to pass a law that prevented the accession of a Roman Catholic. Charles was absolutely furious against the Parliament's attempt to do this. He dissolved Parliament and turned his wrath on the dissenters. In Bristol, for example, the Broadmead congregation, we have, because the Broadmead church minutes exist, very few of the minute books of these early congregations exist, we have a long litany of persecution and from week to week. And they were forced to meet. They actually were, services in town were completely shut down, and they met regularly in woods. And I went through it in preparation for today. I was struck by how many, this is typically British weather, how many Sundays it was raining. And they would meet in the woods in the rain. It must have been horrific. And they were forced to meet in nearby fields or woods to escape detection by the authorities. So March the 12th, 1682, for example, when Samuel Buttle, one of the signatories of the Second London Confession of Faith, preached to the congregation in a field, the churchmen's record, quote, there were near 1,000 people present. And there is, by 1688, it's quite evident to the Anglican Church that they have failed, miserably failed, to control religious dissent. But still, it's amazing that many people would be willing to identify themselves publicly that way. On one of the occasions the Broadmead Baptists met in December of the following year, churchmen note that when they met outside, quote, there was a hard frost and snow on the ground. And though we stood in the snow, the sun shone upon us, and we were in peace. But let me look at three specific individuals, I'm doing so to kind of get a snapshot of what it meant to be a pastor. The first one chosen is Abraham Cheer, one of the first Baptist leaders arrested. He was the pastor of the Baptist congregation in Plymouth. He was jailed in Exeter, which is about 30 miles away. It's more than about 50 miles away, for 3 months in 1661, probably as a consequence of the Venner Uprising. The early years of Abraham Cheer are obscure. One recent writer names his father as John Cheer, who leased a couple of fulling mills. The process of fulling had to do with the preparation of cloth, built by the Elizabethan naval captain Sir Francis Drake at Plymouth. Cheer himself described his parents as mean, that is, lowly in social standing, not what we mean by mean, yet honest. Nathan Brooks, the publisher of one of his books, notes that his parents were also believers who took care to nurture their son in God's ways. Apart from a journey to London in the 1650s, Cheer appears to have spent the entirety of his life in the vicinity of Plymouth, where he was born and raised. During the tumult and turbulence of the civil wars in the British Isles, during the 1640s and 1650s, he was able to avoid fighting with any of the armies, but he did serve for a time in the local militia at Plymouth. This was possibly during the long siege of Plymouth by the Royalist armies in 1643, a siege that failed to drive the parliamentary troops out of the town or bring about its fall. At one point, he also served as an army chaplain, but was able to obtain a discharge after a few weeks. Around 1648 is when he becomes a convinced Baptist, and he says, quote, that he was convinced of his duty to the Lord by evidence of scriptural light, end of quote, and quote, he joined himself in a holy covenant to walk in all the ordinance of the Lord, blameless to the best of his light and power, in fellowship with a poor and despised people. End of quote. This poor and despised people were the Plymouth Calvinistic Baptists. If this congregation had a preacher before Cheer, his name has not come down to us. Cheer is the first known pastor of this congregation. Years later, this will be the congregation that nurtures Samuel Pierce, and the congregation still exists today in Plymouth. Cheer's first imprisonment in 1661 was in the county jail in Exeter. The jail was described by a contemporary quote this way, a living tomb, a sink of filth, profaneness, and profligacy. One of the problems that dissenters had when they were imprisoned, they were imprisoned with other felons, sometimes various ruffians, thieves, prostitutes, who sometimes attacked in the prison dissenters. So they had that, obviously attacks from outside and sometimes attacks from inside. Cheer was set at liberty at Easter that year. On August the 24th, 1662, the Act of Uniformity, he was forced to leave his church and subsequently rearrested. He spent the next 3 years in prison in Exeter. From the second imprisonment, he was released in August 1665, but rearrested within a few months when he started resuming preaching in Plymouth. This time, he was incarcerated on what is called Drake's Island. Plymouth is a fabulous natural harbor and where the British fleet would use as a major naval base. And in the middle of the sound, in the middle of the harbor, there was an island which in this period of time was called St. Nicholas's Island, but today is Drake's Island, named after Francis Drake. That would be where he would die in 1668. After his death, some letters of his were published in a volume entitled Words in Season. And that's what I'm drawing from. In these letters, he reflected a very clear theology of suffering under persecution and its concern for growth in holiness among his correspondents. In one letter, written to a William Punchard, in September 1662, Cheer told Punchard that God's grace was transforming his prison. Quote, these holes of the earth where violence hath thrust us as in so many slaughterhouses of men, end of quote, into, quote, the present chambers of the great king, where he brings and feasts his favorites with the best things, end of quote. And in August 1663, he wrote to a friend recently released from prison of how important it was, quote, to get the heart established in grace, drawn into a more substantial an experimental communion with Jesus Christ, end of quote, and asserted that those who would seek such a deeper experience, quote, may have more advantage from the retirement of a nasty prison than from being left to walk in a large place, end of quote. In other words, he's emphasizing that it seemed to him that walking closely with Christ was better served by being in prison than being free. In line with this, he had written to another friend the previous September to answer a question, should congregations continue to meet during a time of persecution? Cheer insisted the question was not whether there were grounds for continuing to meet, but whether there could be any justification, having taken reasonable care to avoid arrest, for not meeting. Hence, in July 1664, he could write to a friend who had recently been arrested at a meeting for worship, telling him, quote, of his real opportunity to exalt Jesus Christ in suffering for his name's sake, end of quote. On the other hand, Cheer was fully aware that many people had been deeply disturbed by the onset of persecution. Some had fallen away. In one letter, he pictured them, he's picturing then a Baptist congregation this way, the members of it, as a fleet of merchant ships, quote, who set out of their port beautifully equipped and laden with goods, end of quote. Soon, though, they meet a storm. Some hastened back to the home port, determined to adventure such storms no more. Others were utterly wrecked and cast away, while some anchored where they were and wished for the storm to abate. Only a few, he said, pressed on to the port for which they had set out in obedience to their ownest desires. Yet in the same letter, Cheer, who was not a boastful man, could say of his own case, after more than 5 years' imprisonment, I have never yet seen the least reason, and I praise Christ my Lord. Never been under an hour's temptation to relinquish or repent of my testimony in word or deed to any one persecuted truth of Christ for which I suffer. He died on Drake's Island in 1668. A second figure, Andrew Gifford. Gifford really needs somebody to write his life. There is a life of his grandson, Andrew Gifford Jr. called Farthing Rushlight. He was a very important London minister. But his grandfather, who is also called Andrew Gifford, was quite a remarkable figure. And I've really got two kind of accounts of his remarkableness that we'll look at. Born in 1649, he would die in 1721, so he survives this period. Was a Bristol native who was converted in the late 1650s, baptized in June 1659. Subsequently became a member of the Pithay Church in Bristol. His long preaching ministry, one of 60 years, began in 1661, although he did not take on the pastor of the Pithay congregation until 1677. Intrepid in his devotion to preaching the gospel, he would often meet his congregation in Kingswood Forest, then 3 miles from the city of Bristol, at the very place where many years later George Whitefield and John Wesley preached with such success. Quite a number of years ago, I was actually at the spot. There is in the middle of a housing estate, there is a small kind of hillock where there is a pulpit being erected and a plaque that says, at this very point in 1739, George Whitefield began to preach in the open air to a group of Bristol colliers, that is, coal workers and coal miners. But there's also another little plaque, which I remember noticing at the time, but I didn't pay much attention to. It was on the very same spot that the Baptists of Broadmead and Pithay used to meet for preaching services in the previous century. And that's exactly there. It's fascinating to think that the very same spot, God would come and bring revival in the following century. And so they would go there to evade arrest, obviously, because they couldn't meet in the city. In order to evade arrest also, because he was a wanted man, he would also use various disguises, dressing up, for example, as an officer. He actually used to dress up as a soldier and to kind of move around the city freely. And on one occasion, dressed up as a tinker, he met one of his congregation one time coming in through one of the gates and later to ask him, did you see me yesterday? He said, no, I didn't see you yesterday. He said, sure you did. And they described how he'd been dressed up like this tinker to get into the city, because the city would be a walled city with gates seeking to arrest him, obviously. He was imprisoned on 3 separate occasions for fairly brief periods of time prior to the fiercest bout of persecution in the 1680s. A longer time of imprisonment in 1680 was preceded by a remarkable dream, which is recorded by Joseph Ivamy. And the dream is this way, runs this way. His wife dreamed that he, Gifford, arose to go out to preach according to his appointment. But upon opening the door, the very first step he took was up to his knees in snow. But thereupon she dissuaded him, but in vain, that he was seized by 2 particular men whose names she mentioned and brought to the Sun Tavern that then was without or near or outside of Lawford's Gate, which would be one of the entrances into Bristol, and there confined in a dining room, being placed behind a particular table in it. She actually saw the table in the dream. And one of them, by main force, held him down by leaning his right shoulder and the other on his left, obviously until soldiers could come and take him to prison. It made such an impression, she awaked with affright and told him of it and did all she could to dissuade him. But he told her, she talked like one of the foolish women, that nothing should hinder him from his master's business. They arose, and upon opening the door into the yard, they found there had fallen a great snow since they went to bed. This is very unusual in this part of England. You don't normally get snow that deep. And with a severe frost, which had driven up to the house, so the first step was indeed up to his knees. Upon this, she repeated her importunity, but to no purpose. And the result was he was taken according to her dream, and every particular circumstance was the next day exactly fulfilled, which he took as God's great encouragement, that God had clearly forewarned him of this, that he had control of this, and he was in charge of all this. One gets a good idea of the mettle of Gifford from a letter he wrote in 1684 when he was imprisoned in Gloucester Castle to a friend by the name of Edward Grant, who had traveled some 30 miles from Trowbridge to visit Gifford. That is a long, long way. You might think 30 miles isn't much. Most people in England didn't travel more than 20, 25 miles in this period of time in their entire lives. So to travel 30 miles to go and see him in prison was quite a journey. The Baptist minister, in return, was so thankful. He prayed that Grant might have that grace which may keep you faithful to what you know and enable you to do what God does require and contentedly and cheerfully endure whatever in so doing you may suffer. Your peace of conscience, the welfare of your immortal soul, the pleasure and honor of God is to be preferred before goods, liberty, or life itself. Consider, God is able to make you to stand. His grace is sufficient. His strength is made perfect in the creature's weakness. Cry to and rely upon him. Use all honest means to preserve yourself and to prevent your enemies. And use the wisdom of the serpent, but be sure to keep the innocency of the dove. I'd rather, if God is pleased to help me, abide in bonds and the worst that can be done by my enemies than do the least evil for deliverance. Pray for me as I for you, so committing you to him who is able to keep you from falling and present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy. Or a third minister, William Mitchell, who would also survive this period. One of the most important Baptist leaders in Northern England during the worst years of persecution in the 1680s was William Mitchell, a tireless evangelist in the Pennines. The Pennines are the that range of mountains that run down kind of the heart of England, in that Northern England, and are kind of like the spine of England at that point, that area. From the Pennines, from the Rossendale Valley in Lancashire to Rawdon in neighboring West Yorkshire. Mitchell was born in 1662 at Heptonstall, not far from Hebden Bridge in Yorkshire. Nothing is really known about his upbringing. His conversion came at the age of 19 after the death of a brother. Although he was generally converted, Mitchell played what he later regarded as the part of a Jonah, as he sought to go into business as a clothier and become wealthy. But God frustrated his worldly ambitions and drew him out as a preacher of the gospel. Within 4 years of his conversion, he began to preach as an itinerant evangelist. His cousin, David Crossley, a stonemason turned preacher, tells us that Mitchell's aim in his preaching was to, quote, chiefly set forth the exceeding rich and free grace of the gospel, which toward him had been made so exceeding abundant, end of quote. At the same time, we are told that his Christian life was one of unwearied diligence in, quote, reading, meditation, and prayer. Mitchell would often travel with Crossley and others over the Pennines, often during the night, so as to reach preaching venues in towns and villages by early morning. Crossley remembered, and this is it's a very rugged area. Even today, it's very, very desolate and very, very rugged. I remember being not far from Hebden Bridge, to give you some idea of the steepness of the area, and I'd come to an intersection, and all the cars in England are all standards, and I'd never been on such a steep gradient. And you're trying to hang there, balance the clutch and the pedal. And it was a moment of, for me, extreme fear. I can't imagine the sort of exertion that Mitchell and Crossley would have had to do to cross these areas regularly. Crossley remembered the toil it took to walk many miles in dark nights and over dismal mountains. But he also never forgot Mitchell's savoring, edifying preaching that took place anywhere Mitchell could get an audience, on mountains, in fields, and woods. And though he was not a polished speaker, crowds would press to hear him. Many merely came out of curiosity, some to scoff, but when their hearts and consciences had been impacted by his gospel preaching, they confessed the Lord is with him of a truth. According to the Second Conventicle Act, part of the Clarendon Code designed to break the spirit of the nonconformists, what Mitchell was doing was illegal. As has been noted, this act forbade anyone over the age of 16 from taking part in a religious assembly of more than five people, apart from those sanctioned by the Church of England. The act gave wide powers to local magistrates and judges to suppress and dissolve such unlawful meetings and arrest whomsoever they saw fit to achieve this end. Mitchell was twice arrested on this law during the reign of James II, who succeeded Charles II in 1685. On the first occasion, he was treated with deliberate roughness and spent 3 months in jail at Goodshaw. On the second occasion, he was arrested near Brantford and imprisoned for 6 months at York Castle. The enemies of the gospel who imprisoned Mitchell might have thought they were shutting him up in a dismal dungeon. To Mitchell, though, as he told his friends in a letter written from York in the spring of 1687, the dungeon was, quote, a veritable paradise because the glorious presence of God is with me and the spirit of glory and of God rests on me, end of quote. He had been given, he said, quote, such a glorious sight of God's countenance and bright splendor of his love, end of quote, that he was quite willing to, quote, suffer afflictions of the people of God and for his glorious truth, end of quote. In another letter written to a Daniel Moore during the same imprisonment, Mitchell told him he had heard James II had issued a declaration of indulgence which pardoned all who had been imprisoned under the penal codes of the Clarendon Code, penal laws of the Clarendon Code, but he had yet to see it. Whatever the outcome, he told Moore, the Lord's will be done, quote. Let him order things as may stand with his glory, end of quote. This sentence speaks volumes about the frame of mind in which Mitchell had approached this time of imprisonment. He was God's servant, and God would do with him as he sovereignly thought best. And like Andrew Gifford, Mitchell was quite content with that, for in his heart, he, like Gifford, longed for his life to reflect above all God's glory. And then one really kind of summary statement, although Dr. Nettles will summarize, have a longer summative statement later. These three windows into the suffering of the Baptists, Cheer, Gifford, and Mitchell, during this time of great persecution, bears out the truth of 20th century historian Michael Watts, that's the author of this book on the dissenters, statement that this time, quote, had enabled the dissenters, including the Baptists, to reveal their greatest qualities, their faith, their courage, and their largely unwavering loyalty to God rather than to the state. Well, let me stop here. Let me ask if there are any questions, and we will have a short break following.
Although it's illegal, they could still have 1,000 people meet in the woods. I know that most places, 1,000 people met in the woods, the police would be there very quickly. So I'm just kind of wondering, were they all secret meetings that they got together in, or were there, you know, were they the worst kept secrets that everybody knew was happening, but they just allowed it to happen? Were they just after the pastors, the preachers themselves? Were the people persecuted themselves? Were they arrested? Just maybe flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah. The difference between the regime, the Stuart regime of Charles II and James II and a government today like that in China, is that today you have what we would describe as a 20th century phenomenon, which is a totalitarian regime. So it has complete control of the media and all the various technological devices that enable a government of today to control, curtail, arrest, etc. All these people have is a word of mouth, rumors, maybe somebody who would betray a meeting. Then they have to move people out there by horses, you know, cavalry units. So it's quite different in terms of the ability of governments because of the lack of technology to control. And there were spies. Who would sometimes go to these assemblies and who would take note of the preachers. There was a gang called the Hilton Gang in London who during the 1680s actually specialized in betraying preachers. And every preacher they got betrayed, who was arrested, convicted, and fined, they'd get a cut of the money. So they made quite a living out of this. In Bristol, there was a man named Hellyer who was a lawyer. Most interesting lawyer. Most of his time during the 1680s was spent at the head of mobs, trying to basically arrest leaders. It is interesting that you would have that large a number that gather. They either were able to detect to evade detection, or in some cases there were those in some of the justices in the area, although magistrates in the area would turn a blind eye. I mean, we have the case, I didn't get into it because it's so well known, John Bunyan, who spent 12 years in prison, 1660, 1672. And it's a curious imprisonment because sometimes, like he was once invited to a preaching event in London. He's in Bedfordshire. And he asked the jailer, could he go? And the jailer said, fine, as long as you're back on Monday or something like this. He let him out on his own, like a parole. But it was illegal. For him to be doing that. And so sometimes it's got to do with the justices who were deeply impressed. Like Gifford, apparently, there were magistrates in Bristol who would turn a blind eye to Gifford. One time he was preaching, and a number of men came in to arrest him and told him to get down from the pulpit. He said, I'm about God's business. You know, you'll wait there until I finish. And they were so amazed by his countenance, they were told that they just sat there and waited until he finished, until he came to, and at that point he submitted himself to their arrest. So it's a varied scenario. But probably the key difference between that period and this period is the ability of a government today, because of technological advances, to arrest, curtail, and terrorize populations. And also, the other thing that's striking in that period of time, too, is all these guys are given pen and ink and paper in prison to write up their accounts and to write letters. And totalitarian regimes today normally don't want that sort of thing happening. And they're very careful about trying to avoid creating martyrs. And so if people are going to be killed, it's done secretly often. And in those days, you take the person out publicly, and there'd be everybody would see it. So,
just a quick follow-up: were people persecuted? So, were your average churchgoer, were they thrown in jail? Or were they
not usually. Not usually. I mean, we do have examples of that. The people who did get thrown in jail in large numbers were the Quakers, but not normally. I mean, not tons and tons of Baptists. At one point in the early 1660s, there were about 4,000 to 5,000 Quakers in prison in London, which is quite a large number. And compared to them, there were probably around 400 Baptists, who were mostly leaders. Any of the accounts like that, the Beholder Cry, that little sheet, the title page I sent gave out to you, I went through the whole thing. All of the people arrested were men. Only on one occasion did they arrest a woman. Although you have that horrific scene where the guy comes in and he's purposely punching pregnant women. But only on one occasion was a woman arrested, and nearly always they're the preachers and elders that they go for. So. Any other questions before we have a short break?
There was a case of Elizabeth John.
Yes. Yeah, this is during during 1685. Part of the problem in this period is you have a number of plots to overthrow the king or assassinate him, like the Rye House plot, which was an assassination plot to kill Charles II when he was going from Parliament to Rye House or something like this, and they want to kill him on the way. And invariably, there were people in Baptist congregations, unwise individuals, who sometimes were linked to these. I mean, there were a number of these congregations that were still hangovers of the Fifth Monarchists who believed in, it was taken from Daniel, the four kingdoms, and the fifth kingdom was that of the Lord Jesus, which was going to be brought in by armed rebellion. And some of these characters were all hanging around in the 1660s, 1670s, 1680s, and associated with Baptist congregations, which was not good for Baptists, obviously, because it just gave the impression that Baptists were revolutionaries. Also, most Baptists had been Republicans, and quite a number of Baptists had been involved in the military during the time of Cromwell. And the event that Dr. Nettles referred to was actually a rebellion in 1685. An illegitimate son of Charles II, called the Duke of Monmouth, staged a rebellion. And this woman, Elizabeth Gaunt, she hid a minister, I guess, in her home after the rebellion.
One of the participants in the rebellion, I'm not sure.
Yeah. And she was betrayed to authorities, and the judge, a man named Hanging Judge Jeffreys, had her burned.
Considering that it wasn't just Baptists who were being persecuted during these times, was there any mutual support between the persecuted churches, or was everybody sort of on their own?
No, there was. No, and I think that's one of the important byproducts of this period of time, a very important byproduct, is that it forced the Baptists to realize their unity in terms of their worldview and their thinking about the gospel and the Christian life, their unity with Congregationalists and Presbyterians, not with Quakers. And Quakers are really they're a major trouble spot. I mean, whatever Quakers are today, they were a major problem for the Puritan cause in the 1600s. And generally in prison, when Baptists and Quakers got stuck together in the same prison, you would have significant scriptural debates about scripture. Whereas with Presbyterians and Congregationalists, normally there would be the recognition that these people share a significant amount of common space with us. And the product of that is what we call the Second London Confession, which is the attempt by the Baptists to indicate a common unity with their fellow Puritans, in which they used the Westminster Confession, Presbyterian, and the Savoy Declaration, Congregationalist, to draft a new confession called the Westminster, which has been the most important Baptist confessional doctrine in the history of the church, in the history of Baptists. I mean, the abstract of principles, which is our statement of faith here at the seminary, is an abstract, a summary of the Second London Confession, the 1689 Confession of Faith, which was drawn up in this period of time. So that's a major, major byproduct of this persecution. It's ironic that in New England, where the Puritans kind of were running things in Massachusetts and Connecticut, that Congregationalists were persecuting during the same period Baptists, Obadiah Holmes, for example, being whipped on Boston Common by Congregationalists, and men like John Owen in England urging Congregationalists here in New England, well, we're in a common furnace of persecution over here. You shouldn't be doing this. And so the persecution was it has a very important long-term consequences, which are still part of us today. I mean, we wouldn't have had if Baptists hadn't been thrown into that furnace of affliction with these others. You wouldn't have had possibly the Second London Confession of Faith, which meant that the statement of faith of our school might not have been, well, we wouldn't have been there. You would have had to have something different. So it's very significant.
Within these persecuted pastors especially, do you see any struggle against the state in the sense, like more like in a Bonhoeffer sense, where, you know, not sure they should be going this route? I mean, where is the line between obedience to governing authorities and actual obedience to Christ? You know, do they struggle with this at all, or they just know they're on the right course and they're going to be bold and confrontational?
None of the major Baptist figures, their writings that have come down to us from this period of time, men like Benjamin Keach or William Kiffin or Hansard Knowles, or any of the men that I've looked at, none of these men advocated violence. Although we're told that Abraham Cheer thought the revolution under Cromwell was always a good thing. It was known as the good old cause. And he was quite prepared to defend the good old cause all through his ministry. But there's no evidence that once the tables have turned and the Baptists are out of power, that they seek to do the sort of thing that Bonhoeffer recommended. That's the mainstream. There were a few who thought that the way of Venner, for example, was the way that they should pursue. It's interesting. I mean, Bonhoeffer's own recognition was that by engaging in an act of violence against the head of the state in Germany, namely Hitler, he was stepping outside of the church's, the ecclesial realm. And but there had been, although it's not clear among the Baptists in this period, there has been a line among Calvinists that approves armed rebellion against the state, when the state is godless and tyrannical, coming down from people like John Knox. There has been the argument that there are points at which we can take up swords, take up weaponry against the state. None of these Baptist figures are advocating that. Would the 18th century leaders of the Awakening have looked favorably on Oliver Cromwell? Wesley wouldn't have. Wesley would have felt Cromwell was a horrific man. If you just have to read Wesley's public documents against the Americans during the Revolution. I'm not sure about men like Whitfield. Probably Cromwell basically had a deeply besmirched reputation until the 19th century, when Thomas Carlyle, in a book on heroes, rescued his image, and there was a resurgence of dissent in terms of their influence and power. And by 1851, the dissenters, the children of the dissenters, namely the Baptists and the Congregationalists, along with now the Methodists, had more people in church on a given Sunday than the Anglicans. And suddenly they realized, we've got political power. And for about 50 to 60 years, they sought to exercise that. And it's in that period of time, in 1899, that secretly overnight, a statue of Oliver Cromwell appeared outside the House of Parliament. It's amazing. It wasn't actually commissioned by the government, but there was an individual who thought that the state should do something to recognize this great man. And the statue was manufactured, and then suddenly, to the shock of a lot of Londoners, there it was, one particular Monday morning. Now, they must have had some, obviously, apparently it was done overnight. It was done during the night, workmen working on it during the night to put it up. And it's hard to imagine, and the 18th century would never have put up a statue of Oliver Cromwell outside the House of Parliament. It's amazing it's still there and has not been defaced. It's I have a great love for Cromwell. So, anyway. One last question, and then we'll break. No idea. No.
She was not amused.
Okay.